Hey there, ladies and gentlemen. I just wanted to take a real quick second of your time to let you know that I just got done writing the ultimate guide on how to start a podcast. It ended up being over 25,000 words and covers everything you ever wanted to know about starting a podcast, including how to edit the audio, how to get reviews, find guests, and much, much more. So if you've ever thought about starting your own podcast, then you should go check out this free ultimate guide over at gritandhustle.co/podcastingmadeeasy, or just click the link below in the show notes. Now, onto the normal intro.
Right. You know, anytime you're in a podcast or blog, that's evergreen online content that's positioning you as an expert. And so that was the vision behind it. That's why our tagline is, you know, awesome guests, you're a big deal. You know, because we just feel like that's the number one thing you got to realize about yourself. Like, you know some stuff.
What is up, my fellow side hustlers? This is your friend and host, Ryan Helms. I want to welcome you to the Hustle to Freedom podcast. I'm part of a small minority that are taking action because we just aren't satisfied with waking up, going to a 9-to-5 job, then coming home only to repeat it again the next day and never make any real progress in life. We're here to create our own path, our own happiness, our own freedom, and we refuse to be just another cog in the machine. Because we have busy lives and limited resources, we can't just throw stuff against the wall and hope that something sticks. We have to play smart and move forward each day with consistent focus and deliberate effort while using only today's best tactics and most efficient tools. We aren't going to sit back and hope for a 3% raise each year. We are building additional income sources that will allow us to create the life we want. We call ourselves Freedom Chasers. And this podcast highlights the journeys of these everyday people who are creating extraordinary side hustles. Welcome to the Hustle to Freedom podcast. In this episode, I'm chatting with serial entrepreneur Jun Han about his latest side hustle, which is a two-sided marketplace for bloggers and podcasters, meaning if you have a blog or a podcast and you need a guest, then you could find them on this platform. Or if you're looking for a podcast or blog to be on, then you could also find the host on there and pitch them your idea. You can find a link in the show notes, but let's not waste any more time and hear how Jun has built this side hustle now.
Thanks again for letting me be here. I guess the way that I introduce myself most days is the thing that takes up most of my time is being what we call like the lead parent, right? So, you know, traditionally is stuff that moms do. I take my kids to and from school. I do parent association meetings. I do field trips, bake sales, like all that kind of stuff. But the reason I do those kind of things is my wife's a school teacher. But the reason I can do those things is that I'm a serial entrepreneur, you know? And so my story probably starts with my Korean immigrant parents who came here for a better life. Both of them, you know, worked really hard. Typical immigrant thing is, you know, they were educated, but coming here, they had to take like more service kind of oriented jobs. And so they had like 5 jobs between the two of them. But we moved around a lot, like every 6 months. And it wasn't until I was about 10 years old, I realized why. And that's the day the Immigration Naturalization Services, INS, now that's called ICE, but back then it was called INS, came to my school and picked up me and my brother with my mom, then picked up my dad. And then we were deported to South Korea. Wow. So my parents had basically overstayed their visa. So then it all made sense. Like, we had a huge family, but we had never visited them. You know, they never visited us. And, you know, I thought moving around when you were little, like, you don't know how to compare childhood against other people until you get to college, maybe. But like, we moved around every 6 months, which is pretty normal for like, I think army brats and stuff like that. But that wasn't us. So it all made sense at that time. My brother and I are very through and through American, and we were born here. So we could not make it in Korea. It's a very aggressive education system. So there was no way we were going to be college bound in that country. So we came back complete strangers through a series of a chain of different events. But we came back to live with complete strangers where, and they were both, you know, for all purposes of what you call a typical white family, mm-hmm. you know.
So were like, you, not to interrupt you, but were you considered a, like a U.S. citizen?
So we're like what the, we're what like a lot of in the political debates are called like anchor babies, because like we were born here. So then that helps, you know, people leech off of the system or whatever the thing is. My brother and I are citizens, right? Because we were born here. And so, yeah, I mean, my white mom is like seventh generation Italian. I mean, she's white. You know, she grew up in Nevada riding motorbikes and stuff. And then my dad was a Scottish immigrant, thick Scottish accent. So when he got mad at us, like, we'd have no idea what he's saying. Because we're like, dude, I think you're cussing at us, but we don't know because the accent is so thick, but clearly you're angry. You know, like, what's going on? But, you know, what was interesting for me is that I had the two sets of parents, and both of them were entrepreneurs, you know, like all four of them. And that never really clicked on me. You know, I went to college, pre-med, until about a month before I went to college. But it wasn't until, like, you know, I was like, I think I was 24, 25. And when I got out of college, I had a really good boss. And I had actually like three really good bosses in a row. I'm pretty spoiled, I think. And then I got a string of, I think a lot of people that are listening to this guy identified, like, just supervisors that were either not very smart, you know, or not very ethical or something. So I had like a string of a couple of those. And I remember talking to my white mom, saying like, I don't know, like, this seemed like a good fit. Like, I joined this organization or this company for the mission that they're trying to accomplish, but it seems like the supervisor right above me doesn't really care about that mission, you know, or they're making us do things that are not really, don't make sense. And man, my mom, she's a psychologist. She has a PhD in clinical psychology. She's like, hey, June, this is back when this bookstore, she's like, go to the local bookstore and look at the management section, right? Tell me how many books there are. And there are like a couple thousand, I mean, way more than I had thought, right? And I, you know, talked to her on the phone the next week, and she's like, why do you think that is? I'm like, I don't know. She's like, because almost everyone has a crappy boss like that, and they don't know how to not become that, and they're not really trained for that. There's a book called The Peter Principle that says, like, in any organization, people get promoted to the highest level of mediocrity, right? So the logic is that you were good at one job and you got a promotion, but if you're good at that job, you get promoted again, right? But if you're not good at that job, you stay there, and then everyone else has to, like, encounter you. And so that's like the Dilbert cartoons of, like, middle management and all that stuff, right? So she just said, June, you were lucky out of the gate, out of college. You had three really good bosses that you respect, that were super smart, that challenged you. They knew how to deal with a personality like yours. That is probably statistically not going to happen ever again, you know, if you work for somebody else. And I was like, oh my gosh. So I think right around 26 is when I was like, I need to figure out what's next. Like, I can't do this. Oh, I can't be the youngest, smartest person in the room all the time, and my ideas don't get heard and all that kind of stuff. Now, I'll tell you, and I don't know how many people can identify with this. Like, I think I had the skills and experience, and maybe even, you know, I think I had a lot of things I needed to do at 26, jump and start my own company. But man, I was scared. You know, I was just having my second kid on the way. We had two mortgages. The job I had at the time, although not very fulfilling or kind of frustrating, it was the highest paying job I had, and I was getting a raise. Like, I was really good at this job. It was basically, I could keep this job forever if I wanted to. But right around like 28 is when I realized, like, you know what? This is killing me. Like, it's making me a bad husband, a bad father. I'm not a fun person to be around, you know?
What in particular, what kind of pushed you over the edge? What in particular?
Yeah, you know what it was? It's just when I see leaders not doing leadership things, like not making the hard call or not sacrificing on behalf of a team. Like, my big thing is, when you have written values that you hired people for, then if people live out those values in the organizations, they should get promoted, right? And the people that don't subscribe to those values should be getting penalized. Now, the larger organization you're in, you're going to find that those values mean nothing. Like, you know, like, your adherence and selling out for those values that you got hired for and you're excited to work for that company, you're going to find out in most organizations that means nothing, because you don't get compensated for, you know, living up those values, right? And so I was finding people, like, either laterally or above me, going, these guys are not sold out to these values. This is not good. Like, this is a you know, like a, I don't want to say, maybe not illegal, but like an unethical or at least an imbalanced organization. Yeah. And I'm a big cause driven person. Like, if it's for profit or nonprofit, I've always worked for a group because I believe in their mission, right? You know, I believe in what they do. That's why I probably can never work for Walmart, right? I just, you know, we've had some consulting offers from them. I'm like, there's a lot of money to be made in helping them do what they're doing, but like, I just inherently don't like their company.
Yeah.
You know, now Costco, I'd work for Costco for free, because I think that, you know, I think there's things they should reduce on plastic usage and stuff like that, but I think they're a phenomenal company, you know. But I mean, so yeah, I don't know if that makes sense, but it was just like my values weren't matching up, right? Like, I'm a value driven person, so there's only so much I can go through every day knowing that my values got beaten out of me that day by the entity that hired me because of the values I have, right? You know, and so it just, a part of you just dies slowly.
So you're 28 years old, and you decide that you want to with all these responsibilities, the kid, the mortgage, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, we were expecting our third kid even. Yeah. So it was like not a good time. Kids. I mean, going back, I think I probably could have segued. What I should have done, and it's kind of what I'm going to recommend later as we talk, is like what I should have done is thought about what my jump number was. Like, how much money do we need to have in, or how many clients do I need to have to make that jump? Right. But my situation was so, for me personally, intolerable, and I'm not a very mature person. So like, if I don't feel passionate about what I'm doing, I'm probably not bringing my A+ game, mm-hmm. you know, and it's just every day going to work. Like, this is just for the paycheck. This sucks. I never wanted to be that guy, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't want my kids to grow up to be those kinds of people. They're just doing stuff for a paycheck. Right. I just think there's, you know, that's no way to live. Right. I get it. But, so I think for me, I remember talking to both my, these are my white parents, and I'm like, hey, I'm thinking of starting my own company. You guys are both successful entrepreneurs. What do you think? And they're like, man, we don't know what's taking you so long. Like, and this was a blended family, you know, that I was now part of, because you know they kind of adopted us and stuff. Is like, they're like, you're the most stubborn of all of our kids, you know, all the seven of our kids, whatever. You're the most stubborn, and you are also the most like hardest worker we've seen. But you also like course correct really quick. You're the most strategic adapter of the bunch, and which makes you as a young kid very conniving, right? It gets you out of stuff and helps you figure out things smarter than other people. So like, for example, like an entrepreneurial tendency. I remember when I was in my sophomore year in high school, one of my friends from sixth grade was the only guy, like in sixth grade, you got a perfect attendance award. And in elementary school, a lot of us got perfect attendance award. It wasn't that hard. Your parents dropped you off at school, right? So if you didn't get that award, it was your fault, like, or your parents' fault, right? You didn't get that award. But I remember in junior high, it was hard to keep that award, you know, because people would get sick or whatever. So this guy, my friend Anthony, going into our sophomore year, he was still the only last man standing with like perfect attendance. And I remember my mom and dad were like, man, that's so great. Anthony's keeping a perfect attendance. And I was like, wait a minute, I get better grades than him. So what does it matter if you go to school every day? If you're not, you know, it's about the results, right? And so, you know, my parents, it's funny, if they were not entrepreneurs, I don't think they ever entertained this idea. My mom's like, listen, here's the deal. Next year, you're going to take all these AP classes. If you keep your grades up at a certain level, any day you don't want to go to school, I'll write you an excuse. So I was like, deal, right? Now it's just result-based, right? And so, yeah, my junior and senior year of high school, I probably attended school less than I was at the beach. You know, our high school is pretty close to the beach. But I just remember thinking, like, I'm always been kind of like figuring out the hacker way of doing it, right? What's mm-hmm. the most efficient, least laborious way to accomplish what I want, right?
Right.
And so, yeah. So, but remember, I was scared, man. I was like 28 and a half years old. I think at that point, I think I would have thought myself as someone that was very confident in my abilities, but I really wasn't until like those 2 years of just thinking, like, you know what, I don't know if I know everything of what's next, but I need to jump. Now again, in hindsight, I maybe would have kept that job for just 6 months, you know, and basically had a number either saved in the bank or a number of clients like that I hustled on the side and got to create like a jumping number, mm-hmm. right?
But so what were you doing on the side at this time?
At this time, I mean, I didn't have and this is, I think, what defeats a lot of side hustle from growing, is that like my day job was so demoralizing, right? That when I got home, I was just like, I just wanted to hug my family. I was reading a lot of books. Like, I was reading a lot of books about strategy and stuff like that I like, psychology and stuff like that, which all ends up being pretty good for business anyways. But I didn't have any energy to like start my side. And I think it was because I was really deep down pretty scared. Like, I don't know if I could do this, you know? But right around that last like 6 months, I was like, you know what? Even if I eat crap for the next 2 years, that's better than this. You know, that's when you realize you're not in a good working situation. But again, if I was more mature and realized I was having my third kid, we would have been like, you know what? Life would have been a little bit easier. And my conversation with my in-laws would have been a little bit easier than like, I'm leaving the highest paid job we ever had for nothing. Like, you know, that's not a great conversation to have. My parents are like, shoot, go for it. You know, like, you know, build a parachute on the way down kind of thing. But because they're entrepreneurs, right?
Yeah.
My in-laws are not. My in-laws have always had a straight job, you know, working for somebody else their whole life and great lifetime benefits and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, so I did that, and I'm now on my sixth company. My fifth company we put to bed because it wasn't working out very good because of me and my co-founder were really good friends and the company was doing okay, but it was bad for our relationship. And so we figured out, we took a break from doing business stuff with each other for about 2 years just to try to preserve that relationship. relationship. But then we founded our latest company, Awesome Guest, is a co-venture between me and that guy. So we have five companies now and I run two nonprofits. Nice. So I learned a lot like in my first 18 months.
I think this is an awesome segue into Awesome Guest, which is your, like you said, your latest company. Can you give us kind of the 30,000 feet view of what it is?
Yeah, I mean, so right off the bat, I mean, it is still very much, it looks like a legitimate presence and everything works, but it's still very much my venture. Like both my partner and I, you know, we have our other companies that we attend to, and this one is not generating the revenue that, you know, that would merit like a full-time kind of staffing kind of thing. So what it is I realized about 3 years ago, I met a guy and his job, like he has an email list of like over like a million people. And what he does is he basically creates a magazine that any would-be author or expert places an ad in this magazine. And he sends this magazine out for free to like TV or radio producers, because those people need like five or six guests a day. It's like a crazy stressful position, right? And you can't have repeat guests and they can't suck and all that kind of stuff. But this guy is responsible for like Rich Dad Poor Dad becoming a bestseller. And he's responsible for Chicken Soup for the Soul becoming a best-selling franchise. Before those authors had hired him, those books were unknown. They were just obscure. But he hooked them up on this TV circuit and they became bestsellers. Now, I don't think he's recreated that success since, but he still gets, you know, I approached him because I'd known him from 9 years ago when I first started my company. Like, hey, what are you doing for podcasts now? Podcasts are this is about 3 years ago. Because 6 years ago, we did our own podcast for a year just to like, I'm a science guy. Like I studied molecular biology in college. So I'm a big data guy. And 6 years ago, there was not a lot of information about how podcasts work. They were hard to find. It was still mostly iTunes exclusive. Now we did ours for our year experiment. We did YouTube and iTunes. We're going to get more people finding us on YouTube, which is an interesting thing, but there's production time required for that, right? Yeah. But so about 3 years ago, I approached him and said, hey, how are you adapting this like book you send out to radio TV producers for like podcasters? That's like the next wave. And again, this is 3 years ago. And he says, June, two things, man. One is, I don't think podcasts are going to become what you think they are. And I was like, what do you, and then now again, I'm a strategist. That's like my main company, Better San Diego's. We like multi-million dollar companies hire us to do strategy development for them. And I was like, no, it's pretty clear. This is trending. NPR is going to start. It would be a year later before NPR start to refer to their shows on air as podcasts. It all happened within 1 week, you know? And then when they did that, they greenlit all these other shows from their producers of these other shows. And so NPR went from having like 60 podcasts to about 300 within a week. You know, it was crazy. So they're, you know, but, you know, we couldn't have guaranteed that, but it was, so the first thing he says, June, I don't think podcasts are going to become what you think they are. And secondly, how would I get in front of them anyways? Like, I'm not going to send them a magazine. I'm like, well, dude, just send them like a membership site, log in and they could see, or a newsletter, right? Or, you know, different thing. But, so that's, he said no. So for me, like my ethics is usually if I give someone a great idea and he's a good friend of mine, I feel like I want him to think about it a little bit, because it wasn't his idea, right? So it kind of came out of the blue, right? So I give him this idea, let him think out a little bit. I send another email saying, hey, have you decided to do that brilliant idea I gave you? I mean, it's like a, he is best positioned to take advantage of this thing. Because again, he's got an email list of about a million people, a little over a million people that want to be on podcasts or blog, technically, right? So he's got a really built-in kind of customer base. But he said no. So I said, okay. So then the last 2.5 years, my partner and I have basically building Awesome Guests, which is basically 2 years ago when we started to investigate this, which you could find online, and you could still find this today if you wanted to, Ryan, is like, if I'm trying to be a guest on as many blogs and podcasts to take guests as possible, there's these like static like PDFs I could download because someone's trying to like do a list, right? There's one called New Media Summit. There's different people that basically what they send you is like an Excel sheet with like email addresses to pitch that host, right? That blogger or podcaster. But it's just a static list. And the only other alternative is a thing called Help a Reporter Out or Haro, which is basically this horrible listserv email that comes to you like every day with just these things. Now, the problem with Haro is that you might work with a journalist to be part of a story, but they still have to pitch that story. It's not guaranteed that story is going to see the light of day, right? So that's kind of that's not good for, I think, side hustle people that have like 10, 15 hours a week to invest in some good stuff, right?
Because you can, with Haro itself, you can spend a lot of time just replying to these posts. And if you get no bites, you know, you could be spending 30, 45 minutes, an hour writing up something that goes nowhere. And likely no one will ever even see, because they probably don't look at the inundated amount of submissions they get.
Yeah. I mean, if it's a hot opportunity, like, hey, I'm a Wall Street Journal reporter with a column every week, week. That guy's getting like 20,000 submissions. You know, it's crazy, right? So we looked at those two things and we said, well, so we looked at the world of, so Technically Awesome Guests, it's a matching site. And so for the lack of a better analogy, because there isn't an industry alternative, is we looked to job recruiting site and like dating site as far as how they dynamically match people. So, you know, like a company like eHarmony is famous for having a dating matching algorithm, right? And so we spent 2.5 years building an algorithm that says like, I can load up all the unusual things. Like, so here's the thing. If I wanted right now, say my podcast or my blog is about like Muslim entrepreneur women, right? And I need like 5 guests a week for that. How am I supposed to find those people? Because on LinkedIn, you're not going to look up Muslim, right? You know, and you can't really look up women either. You can just look at their face and stuff to see if that person identifies their gender as, you know, but you can't search by those things. You can search by title, right? If you do a Google search on that, you're only going to find people that are already pretty famous, or you're not going to find anything at all, right? So like examples, last year I met with an NPR show, one of their producers, and said, hey, what's one of those obscure guests you're trying to source? They call it guest sourcing, right? And you know, like if you listen to typical like NPR story, they have like 4 different guests or experts that they quote in their story, right? So she's like, yeah, we needed someone preferably Latina, but definitely someone that knew something about the drug cartel world, but also knew something about financial market. Okay, good luck, right? Yeah. How are you going to find that kind of person, right? Like, because on LinkedIn, listen, if I used to do something with the drug cartel, I'm not putting that on LinkedIn.
Right.
You know, unless
if
I'm already
smart, at least.
Yeah. Or unless I'm famous for a book on that or something like that, right? Yeah. Or even more like benign example is like a blogger in Florida that has this huge travel blog. And he's like, June, I want to find people that studied abroad. Okay. But again, how are you going to find that information? Like, how do I know looking at your LinkedIn that you studied abroad? I don't know. I could piece together maybe your school. And then if you had a foreign school listed in there, but that's a really in-depth kind of thing. So we found that on the host side for bloggers and podcasters, they're spending like 7 to 10 hours just trying to find people and then vet them. Like in a podcast, can that person think on their feet? Is your voice at like not an annoying octave? You know, or pitch that whatever, right? All these kind of things, right? For bloggers, it's obviously, can they write? You know, can they write 700 words or can they do 300 words, something like that? So we built this matching site that basically you put in, we ask you all these weird things about you, like what are the 5 weirdest things about you or the 3 things that you're most well known for? You have a long form bio, you have all your social in there, your social accounts and stuff like that. And basically what happens is you get graded on all these things. And then a host signs up, like you would sign up, Ryan, with your show, and you would say, I'm looking for this week, I'm looking for, someone that used to work in a carnival for a summer job, you know, or even like what you're like for the theme of your show, like side hustle, right? You could put that as a keyword and it would pull up all these guests. And initially, the initial ranking is from a host point of view, it's by our awesomeness score, which is like all these things after 2 years of listening to a different host. They told us that just because you have a huge social media following does not usually make you a great guest. Sometimes they're too arrogant or self-important. And so they told us that the best indicator for being a great guest is if they've been on more than 2 podcasts, right? So if you sign up on Awesome Guests as a guest and you have more than 2 podcasts, that gives you a major point, right? Because it means
so they would on the guest side, they would kind of create a profile or a resume, so to speak, of what they've done.
Yeah. And it's basically walks you through it like you're setting up a dating profile. Gotcha. Or like a job profile. Like it would say like, tell us about this, tell us about, and that part is going to get better and smarter and more intuitive. But right now it's like, tell us about this, because we have like 12 different things we ask that to some people seem redundant or fairly like non sequitur. But every single thing we ask for when you sign up as a guest is stuff that multiple hosts have told us they're looking for. And it's important to them in the calculation of will you be a great guest for them. Right now. But now on the flip side though, like say I'm a host and say for my listeners or for my show, Instagram is really important, but my Instagram presence is pretty light, right? As a host, you can say, yeah, I'm going to look up side hustle guests, and then boom, these guests show up. And then I can say, you know what? For the next 6 months, I only want to book people that have a big Instagram following. So as a host, you could sort people by Instagram following and just book those guests, right? Because that obviously help you with your thing. Now on the guest side, we built it again for people that want to be like known as subject matter experts. And this is what I think is important for side hustle audience is how, when I need to make the money on my own, right? Am I already seen as an expert? If I'm not, that's what the first few years of your business is going to be, trying to establish confidence, credibility to get paid what you deserve to get paid. Yep. Right? You know, more, and hopefully it surpasses the job you left, right? That would make sense. But how do you do that? Like, you have to be really good at your job right now and diligent to keep that job, right? And so we think like, well, hey, if on a side hustle basis, you were fitting in 1 or 2 interviews a week or 1 or 2 blog posts a week, dude, in like a year, you've built a pretty substantial case for being a subject matter expert. And after a year of doing that, you're going to realize instead of like pushing yourself out there, the market's going to pull you because you're going to get enough traction that people are like, hey, I heard you on here. We'd like to have you on our show, talk a little bit more about question number two, I'd like to spend 45 minutes just talking about that because that was so interesting to our audience, or, you know, things like that, right?
Yep.
So I think it's, what we're trying to do is saying there's, what's crazy is the leading blogs and podcasts in the world are predominantly interview driven. Like maybe the top 0.1% are driven by a celebrity or personality, right? But the rest of the top like 100 in each one of those in the podcast and blog, they are extensively like interview driven or guest poster for blogs, right? You know, guest contributors. Yep. So they need all these great content. They want to uncover diamonds in the rough and people that are not really well known yet. But because well-known people tend to stick with their brand and say the same thing over and over again.
Yep.
Right? Which is fine because that's what you do. You want to be known for something, you should stick to that. So there's this huge one platform is there's like this huge need from hosts that need guests, right? And using our tool, it only takes about 30 seconds to vet that guest instead of the 7 to 10 hours, right?
Yeah,
and super searching useful. Yeah, and the searching and the vetting. But from the guest side, you're like, but how do I know and how do I pitch? Well, now you're not pitching people that aren't looking for you. You're pitching people that are saying, no, we're on the site because they're looking for you. And they'll usually reach out to you and say, hey, listen, your name came up in our algorithmic search and we think you'd be great for our thing. So it's we feel like we put together a good solution. Now, business principle wise, the problem we ran into is two problems. One, a two-sided platform is one of the hardest businesses to like get going, right? Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, because like, think about like Uber, right? Or think about Lyft. I like Lyft better as a company. I exclusively ride Lyft, right? So think about Lyft. They originally had to say like, we need a lot of people to download the app and want to get ride, right? But then we also need drivers that are available. So the problem is, especially for like a company like that, they didn't have like a huge traction on one side or the other, right? And that's again, why I talked to my friend who already had a list of like 1 million people that would have been in our world on the guest side, right? And so all he needed to do is create this platform and just say, hey, all you hosts out there, we have like 1 million people on this side. Would you like to book them on your thing, right? So what we were spending time doing, and as I was meeting with hosts and asking them what makes a perfect guest for them, I was also saying, hey, would you use our site, right? So right now we've had like 500 hosts, and this is mostly bloggers, but there's some podcasters in there as well, and that's growing. That's going to be the growth dynamic, I think, going forward is podcasters. But right now about 500 hosts, and then right now we have about like 700 free guests and about 200 paying guests. Mm-hmm. And then the features they get are a little different. Just think of like a dating site. Like if you join it for free, you can see the messages come into you, but you can't like send messages, right? Or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
same kind of stuff. Hard for us is like we started this two-sided platform of like we don't have 1,000, 2,000 people on either side. Now, since like in a month from now, we have these partnership agreements with all these podcast hosts because we realize that's pretty much our growth dynamic is the podcast. So look, we have networks of podcasters that are joining our site in the next month. But that's the first problem with the company. The second one is that it would have been easier. This is something just a word to the wise for any entrepreneurial endeavor is like, if there was already a fairly dominant competitor in the market, we would have had an easier time, I think, growing because
that can seem counterintuitive.
Yeah. Because here's why, right? Like if someone is a dominant player, that means, and they're making money, they're not like VC backed, but they're making money. Or even if they're VC backed, I guess people think there's potential in what they do, right? If there is a dominant player, that means there's actually money involved. Like people are paying for that thing, right? And then the question is just the question you have there is, can you build a better mousetrap, right? And so if you build a better mousetrap, like when Google joined the scene, it was already a crowded marketplace, search engines like Lycos, Metacrawler, AltaVista, Excite, and even Yahoo, they were around back, right? So when Google said that they want to become a search engine, everyone's like, that spot's already taken. But obviously not, because they built a better mousetrap, right? The one difference, design difference or user interface difference is they surveyed a younger audience. So not business users like in the 1990s, but younger people, right? Junior high and below. And those people love the clean interface of Google. That there's all, look at Yahoo still today. They're like their page is so full of crap, right?
Yep.
So Google is banking on their algorithm, the strength of the algorithm, the data collection, and that their user interface and like philosophy on life was a better mousetrap. So that's a bet on themselves, right? So for us, we feel like we've built the best mousetrap, but we're having to educate people about the value of the product. Whereas if there was already a competitor, that competitor had already spent time and money educating people on the benefit of that thing.
Yep.
And then all we had to do is come alongside and say, you love this already, and we're so much better than that. That's it, right? But we didn't have that to point to. So it's like, ah, you know, like,
yeah.
What do you do? So that's
it's interesting. interesting. I was on the way home from my day job today, and I was listening to the podcast Business. What is it? Business Wars.
By
Wondery. Yeah, and they were talking about the Coke and Pepsi. They just started a 6-part series on that, and I heard you talk about it as well in one of your talks. But they were saying how, you know, the guy who started Pepsi, he started it after he saw like all the success that Coke was having in the South, and he started it in North Carolina. So yeah, Coke did a lot of legwork with the marketing and getting people into that type of soft drink. So
right, and what Pepsi did, and so this is they don't use this phrase as much, but they used it as a choice of a new generation, right? Because when Pepsi emerged on the scene, Coca-Cola was the established like drink, right? It was on its third CEO at that point. It was seen as like the high class drink, if you will, like what your parents would drink at party, and it was largely supported by Prohibition, because like when alcohol is taken away, people are like, man, now what? You know, and so that's why Coca-Cola is like, boom, that's what we're gonna do. But Pepsi, because Coca-Cola is already established, Pepsi could come alongside like, listen, Coca-Cola is that boring drink for your parent, like you don't want to be like them. And so even if you look at like the 80s and 90s, that's why they did a lot of like Michael Jackson, Britney Spears, like that kind of stuff, because it was all about the choice of a new generation.
Yeah,
now I think they've lost their way in that a little bit, but there's other reasons of doing that. They did that for a purpose, you know, because that's not what the game is now. They both of them bought energy drink companies because that skews younger, right? And both of them have bottled water companies because that skews older. And then both of them are now doing like Gatorade and those kind of drinks because that also skews like youth, super young,
yep.
Right? So they've all been doing their play. But yeah, I mean, it would have really helped us if we had like a dominant player. And so what we're very curious and what we're conscious about is that, you know, we've put it out there. We've been live for about a year now. I know for a fact there has to be at least two or three competitors that are looking at our site every day and trying to build a better mousetrap. Now, what they don't know is that like we track all that stuff, you know? So there's like three people that have been using our site quite a bit, but not to book. They just look around our site all the time and they're not using it to book interviews. So we know who they are. And, you know, we're just trying to see like, hey, I'm curious to see when you guys are going to reach out, just, you know, or maybe I should just reach out to them to scare them, you know? But I like that about business is that they're going to come up with something, some better idea.
Yeah. Push you forward, make your product better.
Absolutely.
So how can something like this, and we kind of hit on it, but how can a service like what you guys are creating, how can that help someone with a side hustle who maybe not this dominant expert on a specific topic, but looking to get their name out there so that they can expedite this process of, if they desire, turning their side hustle into their full-time job?
Yeah, I think it's going to do two really important things. The first one is there is no substitute for game time repetition, right? So in the world of athletics, you could be a practice player, you know, but that is not going to translate when the lights are bright, everyone, you know, your adrenaline's pumping, all that kind of stuff. So it's just like Toastmasters is good for public speaking in general. Like if you know stuff, but you can't articulate it well, the reality is when you join Awesome Guests or something like this, your score is going to be kind of low, right? And so who's mostly going to react to you is a show that might be, you know, just looking for followers and guests. There might be early days also. So the good news is you're really crappy interview might never get heard by anyone, right? But what's going to be funny is that when you become a big deal 2 years down the line, people are going to love hearing that crappy interview. It's going to endear you to them because it's going to be like, whoa, that guy was just like me, you know? And people love, in America, we love like being part of the journey or the growth with people. We just like that as a, the second one is that, it's going to help you like figure out who your ideal like customer is, if that makes sense. That's the hardest like thing for people who have never been entrepreneurs before, is that when it comes to marketing and sales, like there's three things you need to do in business. If you're starting your own company, you have to be good at sales and marketing. That's one bucket. The next bucket is you have to be good at your technical skill, right? And the third one is you have to be good at management, which is operations, finance, project management, team leadership, right? Those kinds of things. So usually people start a side hustle because they're good at the technical thing. They have a passion for it, right? Like I'm a really good plumber, or I can build chips in a bottle, or I'm a really good like infographic creator or something like that, right? That's a technical skill. But if you can't do sales and marketing, you cannot be in business, right? And if you can't do the management side, you can't stay in business, the problem, right? Now, sales and marketing, the number one thing is that is you gotta know like with extreme precision who your ideal, like you might say everyone can buy my service or everyone can buy my product, but that's not the question. The question is who is most likely to buy it from you, right? Because Ryan, you and I could start the same kind of company and the same product, right? But based on who you are and the way you talk and who I am and my perspective, people are going to prefer to buy from you or me. And we're going to have different people. And if we get good at our marketing should never really overlap because we have two different kind of things. And that's not in the marketing world. That's more what they call psychographic, not demographic. It's the way someone thinks, not the age or household income. Like that stuff's important, like gender or region. But really nowadays with marketing, because online world is so makes everything ubiquitous, it's really about the psychology of the person that's likely to buy from you, right? And the thing is, when you're not out there, like your day job is taking up all your hours, you're not out there, have time to network and market test your ideas and stuff like that. The best way to do it is to do it through content, right? Evergreen social or online content. And what you do is you go like, oh man, I thought I killed that interview and that audience hates my guts, right? Or more realistically, they don't hate your guts, but they had all these other questions. You're like, oh, I thought point one and two was how I was going to make my money. But based on their feedback, point four and five is really where I need to hang my hat. You know, I really need to pronounce it. So like there's a guy named Seth Godin. He's like one of the earliest like big time bloggers and he's only does marketing really for the most part, right? His last three books were written in this way. He would see a blog post get a lot of traction, and he's very active. Like his full-time job is responding to comments and emails. That's crazy. That's like his full-time job.
Doesn't he post like one a day, one blog a day?
Yeah. He does crazy. And he'd been doing that for a long time, by the way. It didn't happen overnight. He did it in the early days, right? Yeah. So, but what he did is like his last three books, which are all bestsellers, were written in this way. He would see a blog post that was very active, get in there and talk about it. And then based on the interactions with the commenters, right, back and forth, he would do another blog post about that subject, right? And then he'd find like, okay, 12 of these were super popular. Guess what? That's a book. That's 12 chapters, right? Someone's going to transcribe the best of that. And he's going to add a little more research and some flair to that. And then guess what? When he's time to market that book, he just mentions it in that feed. And people are like, oh my gosh, that's great. Because, you know, I would like to hear more what you thought about this after you had time to research it because you're an expert, right? So if you don't have time to network and in person figure out like what your ideal customer is and the objections and the questions they have and why they will or will not buy from you, putting your content in, I think podcast is probably the best way, right? But also if you have a very technical thing, maybe blogging might be a little bit better, right? But it's going to help you market test your ideas to go like, oh man. And you never know, like one podcast might really catch on fire because your idea was that great. Well, then at that point you reach out to that host and go, hey, listen, I'm going to do a Kickstarter and get me out of my day job, you know, and that host and hosts like it are going to help you do that kind of stuff. But that stuff doesn't happen by accident. It happens because you were out there putting the idea out there for people to examine it. Right. The hardest thing about side hustle stuff is that you're working in this palace of your brain in obscurity. Well, how do you know if people really want it or not? Right. Also, I mean, at one level, how do you know if your stuff is any good, really? You know, like when I tell someone wants to be an artist, like a graphic designer or a web designer, I go, listen, the easiest way to do that right now is look at all the, like if I was a web designer and I needed to hustle some business and someone put a gun to my head and says, June, you need 5 clients at the end of this month. This is what I would do. I would find some websites of popular companies and I would design a mock redesign of how I would do it differently. And why? It's important is why, right? Because that why is going to be important to certain people. Like, you know what? I like the way you're thinking, man. I'm going to hire you for my service, right? So what I would do is I would take a leader of a market, redo their website, and then send it to all the competitors of that company, right? Maybe just out of courtesy, I'd reach out to that company first and go, hey, I just had to put this together. You're under no obligation, but this is how I change it. And importantly, again, why? You're flexing your expert muscle.
Yeah, for sure. Right?
So I would approach them. And if they said no, then I'd go to the next 10 competitors and go, listen, your competitor is an idiot. Like we redesign now for some of you might not agree with what we're saying, but one or two of you are going to understand the logic behind how we redesigned it and you're going to buy from us, right? But again, like it's like, you know, last week I met with someone and she's like, hey, I just got done with my graduate degree, I want to work in this industry, what should I do? And you know, she's going to look through my LinkedIn contacts. Well, you know, the number one thing you should do is put together content, like either guest post or be a guest on podcasts, so that when I'm looking to hire you, so I'm going to look at Ryan as applicant A and June as applicant B, right? Ryan has been spending at least once a month blogging. Again, just on your own. You're not trying to like say that I'm trying to be an internet famous. Like you just want to put your thoughts out there, right? So by the time you apply, you have at least 12 blog posts and at least 12 podcast interviews. And then I'm applying with just my resume, right? And the other advantage is that when someone Googles you or whatever, not just your social stuff is going to show up. It's right. All this other expert stuff that's going to show up, right? And the reason I say you don't have to do like, you know, if you're blogging for a living, you need to blog like 2 or 3 times a week, right? Or something like that. But that's not what this is. This is more like credibility piece, right? So all I need to see is that you've been consistent. So like once a month, right? And I need to see that you did something within the last month. I just want to see if you're relevant still, right? And so that's like the number one job search advice I give to like all these MBA students that I mentor, and they never do it, man. And I was like, but it's free, man. It's free. Like right now, it's free for you to create that content. And then, you know, more importantly, show up on other, like if I have 5 blog posts of my own, now I can reach out to other bloggers and go, hey, I'd like to write some exclusive content just for you along these lines, or we could do an interview or whatever. So I think for side hustle, I mean, there's a lot of stuff I wish was around when I first started my company. Like the internet is not what it was when I first started my first business. So to establish my own like credibility, I had to do a lot of in-person workshops and then muster all the people to show up. And we got some clients out of that. But man, it'd have been so much easier if the online world was built out the way it is today, where basically I can just in obscurity, like I might hate my day job, or maybe I don't hate it, but I don't love it. But like what I do love is every night I'm going to put together a blog post, or at least once a week, I'm going to spend every day researching something. And then on Saturday, I'm going to push it out, right? Or I use a site like Awesome Guest, because, you know, if it's around, I go, hey, listen, I'm going to book myself on 2 podcast interviews every week, you know, because it's practice, like talking about my idea, talking about what I love. That's game time repetitions, man. You can't fake that. You just can't, you know. I'll tell you a story. Like one of my favorite author stories is John Grisham. And John Grisham worked as a lawyer, and he was like a peon in this huge law firm, which is what you're supposed to do, right? You're supposed to get onto like a huge law firm and then wait your way to partner, right? But he realized very early on he was horrible at getting new clients. So he's never going to become partner in this company. So he just like, but he realized like about a year in, he hated being a lawyer, and he was a peon. So he hated being a lawyer, but then what was his option? Like he can't become partner, which is the good life, right? So, but he fancied himself like a writer. So every day, rain or shine, even if he pulled in, even if he was homesick from work, he would spend 4 hours a day writing. 4 hours a day, right? You know?
Wow.
And so then about 6 years later, one of his friends heard that he'd been writing so much and had him join one of these writing groups. So a lot of writers, they're very cool. They support each other. And then basically one of his friends, without telling him, took a couple of his things and sent it to her agent, her literary agent. And her literary agent's like, yeah, does he have more of this stuff? And she's like, yeah. So she got him a book deal, right? So it's interesting. About 3 years ago, I remember at Costco, I saw like, you know, in the book section, there's a new John Grisham book. And I had never really seen the marketing around that and stuff like that. And then just like, you know, like an earworm kind of thing. Like I saw that cover. And then that week, NPR had an interview talking about that book coming out. And I remember the thing he said in the interview is he was the most scared of this book coming out, because what happened is when he got discovered, he had 6 years of a back catalog of writing. So when his first book was either The Rainmaker or Time to Kill or something like that. And then like a year later, he had all those blockbuster movies come out, right? So when he got discovered, what publishers do is they edit the book. Like they make it more readable. Like you're not a very good writer, so let's change it around, right? Now, what they had seen was his latest writing. His most recent writing, which is 6 years down the line, right? So he gets discovered, book deal, and they go, what else do you have? He just gives them boxes and boxes of 6 years of his writing. And so basically the editing team starts to put together these books in the John Grisham franchise, right? And then the book that came out 3 years ago, I should remember the title. I didn't buy the book, but he said he was the most scared because that was the first book he had written since becoming John Grisham. And so he was really nervous on how it would do.
Right, yeah.
Because all the other books were heavily editorialized and fixed and stuff like that. So this is the first book he had written since he had been discovered, which is like 12 years later, some crazy thing, right? But I love that he did that every day. Yep. He did that every day, right? Because that's, yeah, but that's what he could do though.
Yeah.
Like that writing, that's like a game time, again, game time repetition, right? It's like when they ask Seinfeld, like, I think you can still find it online. There's a thing called Don't Break the Chain. And basically he's giving this lecture to some like arts, you know, school or something like that. And someone gets up and asks the question that he's probably asked every time, like, what made you such a great comedian that I could start doing today, right? And in this, it's like a grainy, really old video. And he's like, you know what? Sit down, kid. I'm not going to answer this question because no one ever does it. And they're like, you know, no, like, you know, everyone's like, no, you know, give us the answer. He's like, no, I'm not going to, because it's not sexy. And I'm telling you right now, none of you are going to do it. The reason none of you are going to do it, because even in my own industry, there's only a handful of people to do this, right? So I'm not going to tell you. It's pointless. And everyone's like, no, you know, blah, blah, blah. So then he's like, fine. Don't break the chain. He's like, the key to being a good stand-up comedian is you got to write every day. He's like, I write 4 hours every day. I write for 4 hours every day. And he has one of those like old at-a-glance calendars that has those boxes, right? And so when he says don't break the chain, what he'd do is if he wrote that day, he'll put a red X through that square. And then you put red X to red X, they create these chains. And so he can point to sheets and sheets and sheets over years where that chain has never been broken.
Wow.
That means that dude is professional, right? And it's funny, if you were to analyze his stand-up routines against some of the best out there, like a Kevin Hart, you know, Chris Rock, you know, Louis C.K., even though it's controversial, that kind of stuff, right? And even, you know, Bill Cosby, obviously, you know, my whole childhood was ruined because of that guy. But like, if you look at the way, if you analyze their routines, it's clear that they were good writers. You know, Louis C.K. is interesting because he's the one guy in that stratosphere that when I look at his routines, there's so many off-the-cuff remarks that he does spontaneously that are funny that those weren't written, you know. And so I look at it all the time when I study like stand-up comedy. I go like, if I ever get to interview that comedian, I'm gonna ask them, hey, at the 27 minute mark of your Netflix special title, whatever, you said this one comment and it was hilarious. Was that scripted or not? Right? With Seinfeld, they're all scripted, huh. All of them. And I've come to learn, like, people like Chris Rock as well, they're all scripted. But
it makes me think of stand-up comedy, but this is kind of random, but the movie Dumb and Dumber with Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
There was a part in the movie where he was walking out of a gas station with like this big soda drink. They were getting back in that van that would look like a dog.
Yeah, getting the dog van.
Yeah. So apparently like everything that he said there was supposed to be like an outtake. It was just like a one-off, like, let's just run through this. Yeah. And he just completely off the cuff did that whole dialogue. And it was like one of the best parts of the movie.
Right. That's what, like, if anyone that's ever worked with Robin Williams or Jim Carrey, they'll say that about those guys. Right. And so that's interesting. Like when Robin Williams took his own life, all of the Hollywood industry all looked at someone like Jim Carrey and like, is that guy safe? Because they had the same genius, you know, and they're crazy genius. So is that guy safe? Right. And you see that with a lot of creative kind of types with like Anthony Bourdain or Kate Spade, right? If there's this highly creative, innovative side, it comes from a lot of hurt and broken places, you know. But I mean, those guys are brilliant. And, you know, those people say, yeah, this is some of the funny stuff in that movie is stuff that never made it onto print because it's what happened behind the scenes or whatever, right? But yeah, I mean, so going back to Awesome Guests, I think this is not the only tool, obviously, but if a side hustle person can build up their credibility and game time repetitions as far as practicing talking about what you do in a way that's interesting and compelling, but also like figuring out your laser focus on who will most likely buy from you personally, you know, and the brand that you're going to set up, that'll get you like almost 5 years a head start if you jump full time or all that kind of stuff. And the reality is obviously you can market part time, right? You know, anytime you're in a podcast or a blog, that's evergreen online content that's positioning you as an expert. And so that was the vision behind it. That's why our tagline is, you know, awesome guests, you're a big deal, you know, because we just feel like that's the number one thing you got to realize about yourself. Like, you know, some stuff, yeah, you know, so you know, some things, you know,
for sure. No, that's awesome. You know, getting out there, establishing that credibility, getting that huge head start on the people that may be there building their mousetrap, it can help you get ahead. So, you know, where can people find out more about Awesome Guest and about you if they're interested?
Yeah, I mean, for me, you could just find me on LinkedIn. You know, you look at your show notes and stuff like that. And I think for you guys, so right now, Awesome Guest, this is our decision because it is a two-sided marketplace, like experiment, right? We are giving podcasters a way to like make a little bit of money just by trying out the site, right? And in the dating analogy, like a podcast or a blogger, a host looking for guests is like in a dating world, like our pretty girl analogy. Mm-hmm. Like they get everything pretty much for free. The site is built to make it super easy for you, because if you don't use it, then it doesn't matter, right? As far as the two-sided economy. And on the guest side is where people pay for it. About 80% of the features that anyone would ever use are free, you know, so you could set up a profile, still be found, still book and all that kind of stuff. But so what we're doing now is like I said, about the next month, about 8 weeks, we have these rolling waves of like very large number of hosts joining our site. And so the only way to join our site is you can just go and, you know, join and pay full price, or for your listeners, we'll put a link in. And so the only place you can get this link is there's about 80 of us, what we call founding affiliates. And they're the only people that you can get this thing from. Everyone else has to just pay whatever the site says. But what we're doing is our affiliates are the only ones allowed right now to sell lifetime membership. Mm. You know, we're going to be around for a while. We have I think we're going to grow aggressively for about 6 years. And then the last 4 years is going to kind of plateau a little bit before the industry completely changes with self-driving cars and home audio devices and stuff like that. We have a very steep growth ahead of us for the next 6 years as far as people joining the platform, and then it's going to drop off about 4 years, and then after that it's not going to drop off like a cliff, it's going to die very slowly because the medium is going to change. So a lifetime membership we feel is very valuable because you're going grandfathered in. We have like four really big features that we're working on them right now, but they're not going to be available till like February or March of next year, right? And so the lifetime members get all that grandfathered in and stuff like that. So just go to your show notes and then we'll put the link in there.
Cool. Well, June, it was a pleasure chatting with you. I had a blast. And I'm sure sure the listeners got a lot of it out of this.
Oh yeah, man.
Well, I'll be for sure to link everything up in the show notes. I'm gonna head over to Awesome Guest now and set it up from my side. So I'll give it a test run and give some real world feedback.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because this is definitely I can speak from the host perspective. It can be challenging sometimes to one, find guests, and then two, find a qualified guest. So I think what you're doing is amazing, and I appreciate you taking time out, come on the podcast and share about your side hustle and how you're growing it and your background. So I appreciate it, June.
Yeah, absolutely appreciate it. Thanks for the time, man.
Yep. Talk soon.
Bye.
I hope you got a ton of value from that episode. Be sure to go check out June's side hustle, Awesome Guest, by clicking the link below in the show notes. And if you haven't already, go ahead over to gritandhustle.co and pick up your free copy of the Side Hustle Journal now. So, Freedom Chasers, if you like these episodes, be sure to go rate and review the podcast in iTunes or in the Apple Podcast app. It would mean a ton to me. Until next time, keep hustling.